New Testament reading this morning is taken from the book of Romans. It's chapter 8. I will begin reading at verse 18. Romans chapter 8, beginning at 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that's about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning with labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for the adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what they've seen? But what we hope for is what we do not see. We wait with patience. This is the word of the Lord. Now I'm praying desperately that I'm going to turn around and poof, my iPad will be there. Let's try this again. We're going to wait. Because hope is not what we see. It's what we anticipate. Let's try that again. Here we go. Aha. I see nothing. All right, okay, well, we'll just do away with that for today. I've always found it strange that the Bible begins and ends with a creation story. We start with Genesis 1 and 2. We have not one, but two creation narratives there. When we're finished, Revelation 21 and 22, those are two creation narratives as well. We're about to go into Holy Week. And if we went out on the street and asked people, what is Holy Week about? And if we're fortunate and we don't get Easter Bunny or Spring Break, people would say, well, Holy Week's about maybe Jesus dying so we can go to heaven someday. And a few people might say, well, Holy Week's about God showing us how to live the way we should live. And those are okay answers. I struggle with what they mean in the middle of a book that begins with two creation stories, ends with two creation stories, and of course has creation stories all the way around in the middle. So this morning I want to try and do something that I've never tried before. I want to talk my way through the entire Bible in 30 minutes. We're going to start with the two creation stories in Genesis. We're going to wind up in the book of Revelation. And in the middle, hopefully, we're going to take a stop at the book of Romans. Now, I can see some of you. I know what the emails are going to look like Monday morning when Pastor Bryant gets back in his office. Don't let the Dan de Beersheba guy back in that pulpit ever again. But I promise you, we're just going to tell a story. So let me go over to a place where I've got some notes for myself, and we'll tell that story. The book of Genesis begins with the six-day creation account. In the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth, and it's the big, giant, glorious story of creation. In 6 days, everything that is. Now, my guess is that the six-day story really mirrors other creation narratives in the ancient world, and Israel wasn't making a case for six 24-hour days of creation as much as it was entering in with the view of the Babylonians, where the story was probably first put into its final form. They were trying to say something about their God, and what they wanted to say was the God of Israel was a God of order, not a God of chaos. That the God of Israel was a God of abundance, not a God of want and need. In Genesis 2:4, We shift gears because we go into another creation story. And this one's quite distinct. In the six-day story, we have, you know, man doesn't come along until the sixth day in the story. The zenith of the creation in Genesis 1 is the creation of the man and the woman who come together. In Genesis 2, in verse 4, God creates the heavens and the earth, and then we have a problem. It says that the earth couldn't produce things because there was no one to work it. And the word work there gets really close to the idea of serving. So God had created an earth, but there was no one to serve it. And so guess what he did? God creates Adam. Adam is put into the creation, Genesis 2, so that the earth can be productive and do what it was made to do. Adam comes out of the earth in Genesis 2. He's formed out of the dust of the ground. Well, that works out okay, because now in Genesis 2, we start to have a garden, and we have lush trees, and we have water running around. The problem is that the man is bummed out. That's in the Hebrew. He's lonely. This God of the Hebrews is a God of plurality. Even God wasn't by God's self. And God looked and said, that's got to be a bummer job, working the ground all day with nothing around you. And so in Genesis 2, the next thing God creates is the animals. And God creates the animals out of the same dust from the same earth that God created Adam. And the animals are all brought to Adam, and God says to Adam, look what I've made, look at them and see if one of them is going to be able to go shoulder to shoulder with you. And Adam looked, I think, at the alpaca and snickered and said, wow, needs a hair job. And Adam looked at the elephant and says, wow, that's a monster nose. I'd like to think God brought Adam a golden retriever. Adam probably said, cool dog, but eats deer poop. Not somebody I want to sleep with at night. And so in the Genesis 2 story, after Adam names all of the animals, Adam looks and says, there's still no one that's going to walk shoulder to shoulder with me. And God says, well, I'll fix that. And so from Adam comes the woman. And finally, Adam looks and says, aha, there's somebody who can look at me eye to eye. We can walk shoulder to shoulder, eye to eye. It was a great world in Genesis 2. In fact, there was only one rule in the whole place. The one rule was, in the middle of all of this paradise, God has set a tree. It's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's nothing magical about the tree, but there is something magical that happens when people take for themselves decisions about good and evil. Because in the creation, the ability to look and say, that's good or that's bad and we're going to correct it, that was God's prerogative. God told the man and the woman, the one thing you can't do is take that to yourself. Well, you know what happens in Genesis 3. We have the serpent, we have the tree, we have the fruit. And we have uh-oh. The story of the fall, it's called in Genesis 3, is not so much about the fruit as it is the action. The idea that God said, I know what's best for my creation because I've created it abundant and connected. Just don't do this. And when the tempter comes to tempt Eve, what does the tempter say? Ah, God knows you ever eat this and you're going to become just like God. Your eyes are going to be open and you're going to know good from evil. So the problem is that the creation was always supposed to be interconnected. And the fall is about one part of the creation saying to other parts of the creation, you're good because you meet my needs. You're bad because you don't meet my needs. You know the story. They eat. It seems that we cannot but cross the line that God says don't cross. Now, it's interesting, at the end of Genesis 3, things happen. Because in Genesis 2, the creation is all connected together.
But as soon as this act happens, as soon as the man and the woman take it upon themselves to know good and evil, and the word know there probably means to experience, not to know in the book sense, but to know in the sense of been down that road and know what's going to happen, things begin to fall apart. Adam's connected to the animals intimately, but as soon as this act happens, the first person God talks to is, of course, the snake. And what God says to the serpent is, I'm going to put enmity between you and everything that had to do with Adam and Eve. Enmity means I'm going to put you in eternal struggle with them. That's not something we see in Genesis 2. There is no enmity in the Genesis 2 creation. But in Genesis 3, right off the bat, we have enmity. Come down just one more verse and it'll say at the end of Genesis 3 that God has to clothe the man and the woman. And how does God do that? Well, with the skin of animals. In Genesis 2, everything was connected to everything. They were all the same. But by the end of Genesis 3, the animals are giving their lives so the man and the woman cannot be embarrassed at the fact that they now know that they're naked. And wow, he didn't do his sit-ups, and she's looking a little bit old these days. It just didn't work. Things start to fall apart in Genesis 3. The man and the woman were from each other. They were side to side. But listen to what's said. Genesis 3:16, God speaking to the woman, God says to the woman, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, there are about a million ways to interpret that verse. Let me give you the kindest way that we can understand that. God says to the woman, you're going to really like this. You're going to look at the man forever, and it's going to be for you just like the garden. And then God says, and it will never be that way. Because he's going to want to be the boss of you, as my kids would say. Now, I think there's a less kind reading, which would be God saying to the woman, you and the man are going to struggle forever about who runs this show. Your desire is going to be for him to rule over him, and he's going to want to rule over you. We don't see that in Genesis 2 at all. They're eye to eye, they're shoulder to shoulder. But in Genesis 3, they are told, you're going to spend like Remus and Romulus at the gates of Rome. You're going to spend your time jostling for position. Wow, that microphone is going to kill me. Try that again. And finally, to the man. In Genesis 2, everything came out of the earth, and everything would go back to the earth. The man, the plants, the animals, everything. But listen to what God says to the man. Because you've heard the voice of your wife, you've eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil, you're going to eat all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall break forth for you, and you're going to try and eat the plants of the field. The earth, which in Genesis 2 had been abundant and giving life, God says to Adam, wow, this is going to get messed up. You're going to spend the rest of your days sweating like a dog working the field just to scratch out an existence. And that great field of corn you just planted, well, Monsanto's not around, and so thorns and thistles are going to be all over there. You're going to sweat and you're going to die. And with this all over, you're going to go back to the earth. It wasn't the way it was intended, but it's what we end up with in Genesis 3, which is a creation set on itself, at war with itself. And then we come to Paul's nifty little comment in the book of Romans. Romans is all about what Jesus has done for us. The thing, Easter, what's going on? And we want to think about Romans about, you know, going to heaven when we die. But in the middle of the book of Romans, exactly in the middle, listen to what Paul says. He's talking to the Christians. He's saying God has done this phenomenal thing for you. Whatever is wrong with your relationship with God has been set right in Jesus Christ. So if God's justice has claims against you, Jesus has satisfied those. If God's law has claims against you, Jesus has lived up to the law. If somehow God's justice has been offended,
Jesus has set that right. And so the Roman Christians want to know, well, great, if all of that's happened, why hasn't our world changed like right now? And Paul says, well, it's not quite that way. It's on the verge of changing. Let me explain this to you. Paul says in Romans 8:20, have you ever thought about the creation? He says in Romans 8:20, the creation was subjected to futility. Now, there's a bunch of words there that are interesting. The cycle of life and death. As a pastor, I don't know how many times I've been in a funeral, and the thing that comes again and again and again at the end of someone's life is the futility of spending your entire life learning how to live well only to have your body fail. And at whatever point that happens, it seems to me a pity. There is a futility to that. I don't know about you, but I've been around for 50 years, and they were 50 hard-earned years, I have to tell you. And if you gave me the option of going back and being 20 again, I'd take it in a heartbeat, but I don't think I would because it cost me too much to learn what I now know. There's a futility to that. Paul looks at the creation and says, have you ever understood that the creation, there's a futility there? And then he says, and that futility, and by that I think he means the cycle of death. So all of the animals die, and the earth produces not just the plants that we need, but thorns and thistles. And not only do we get the gentle rain that produces the harvest in the spring or in the fall, but we also get the hurricanes that upset entire cities and nations. All of that happens, Paul calls it, subjected to futility. And then he goes on and says, not of its own will. The creation, this didn't happen to the creation because it wanted it this way. Paul says in Romans 8:20, it happened by the will of the one who subjected it. And who, pray tell, is that? Who in the Genesis 3 story subjects the world to futility? It is God. It is God, and it happens because the man and the woman had to know good and evil. We are the ones who set the creation against itself. And Romans 8:20 says that God had to bind the creation into this cycle of futility until something could be done about it. Wow, what in the world, Pastor Clint, can be done about it? Well, we're back to that story of Jesus. Romans 8. Listen to verse 21. Again, we're talking about, what he's saying is that the creation is just like people who know that Jesus was the Messiah and who know that Jesus will set them right with God, who want to say, man, I'm ready to go. I want to go wherever God wants me. Let me go to heaven today. Why do I have to keep hanging around here? And Paul says the creation is the same way. The creation right now is bound. It is still in this cycle of futility. And then he says, in verse 21, the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay, and it will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The creation, Paul says, has the same promise that you have and that I have. Wow. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, but not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. We groan inwardly while we wait for the adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Let's work backwards for a moment. Paul says that we groan, that we look and say, God, how long? If I'm really going to have a glorious body, how long do I have to continue with, you know, my knees that are sore and with my hip that hurts and the back that doesn't work well? How long, oh God, how long? How long do I have to suffer with the stuff that I wrestle with out of my own background, the fact that I don't feel good enough for God to love me, and I can know that in my head all I want to, but I've got baggage in my background. How long, oh Lord, how long? Paul says we groan for that. We want to know. When will we know and experience this as a reality? Paul says we groan because someday, and he says, in fact, God's given us a down payment. Just in case we think the deal with God's bad, God gives us the Holy Spirit. It's the Spirit's the down payment. It's the part of God that says to us, yes, but you are beloved. Yes, but someday you'll put on immortality. Yes, and someday you'll see and you'll understand. Paul says that same thing is true for the creation.
If you and I have a hope, if you and I have been redeemed by Jesus' death, made the children of God, promised a someday, so Paul says, has the creation. Wow. That's not the Jesus that we keep in the church. That's not the Jesus that we have one of 7 days a week. That's a different kind of Jesus, because Paul says, if you go back to Genesis 3, what went wrong was that all the interconnections started to break down, and the man and the woman are broken down, and the man and the creation are broken down, and the man and the earth are broken down. And then he says, and incidentally, the Creator came to put that right. And so the creation, just as we do, the creation looks and says, how long, O Lord, how long? I said we'd wind up in the book of Revelation. I'll assign that as homework. Let me just go to Revelation 21 for a minute. Just listen. Revelation 21, the final vision of the apocalypse of St. John. Then I saw, John says, a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. God will dwell with them as their God, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. Then listen to verse 4 carefully. God will wipe every tear from their eye. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. Death, mourning, crying, and pain. What does that sound like? That sounds like Genesis 3. The difference between the first and the second creation, what's new in Revelation 21, why it's called a new heaven and a new earth, is because whatever happened in Genesis 3 that set things apart is done away with. And so in the new creation, it's like, you know, it's like the Upper Peninsula on steroids. Or it's like the Rocky Mountains, 7x24 everywhere. Whatever your version, actually my version would be, it's like the beaches in the Bahamas, everywhere. Except there's no bills. And there's no death. And there's no suffering. And there's no strife. And there's no enmity. And there's no discrimination. And each of us get to be the people God created us to be. And as importantly, all of the creation gets to be the part of the creation God intended it to be. Brothers and sisters, in 7 days we enter Holy Week. It's awfully easy during Holy Week to walk through the events. Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Palm Sunday, Easter Vigil. It's church stuff, and that church stuff competes with the spring break vacation plans and the Easter Bunny pictures and all kinds of stuff. But I want to remind you today that the Jesus of the Bible is not a teeny tiny Jesus who comes just so someday we can be spirited off somewhere else. The Jesus of the gospel stories is the Creator God, who steps into the creation, looks at Genesis chapter 3 and says, I will undo that. And so I will throw myself into the very jaws of death so that death itself can be reversed. May we see this Easter the cosmic Jesus, the conqueror of death, the one who wins for us the new creation. May that be the Jesus we experience and see in the weeks to come. Amen.